This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Well, today on Dreamland, we're going to be talking about my new book, A New World, but in a very different way. The roles are going to be reversed, and I'm going to be interviewed by Josh Boone. He is the director of The Fault in Our Stars, Stuck in Love, The New Mutants, which is an X-Men spinoff, and more recently, The Stand for CBS All Access that hasn't been released yet. He's also directing a series based on my life. In the third half hour, I'm going to be going a little deeper into the book with subscribers. The book is not a how-to, but it is about making contact, and there are already some people reporting that this is happening. The visitors worked directly on the book for the last 2 years, and they are taking a direct interest in people who are reading it. I'll be discussing some of these cases and what to expect if they come into your life. In general, it will not be physical contact, but that's obviously not impossible because it does happen from time to time. It will be surprising and can be shocking, and I'll be talking about how to notice their presence and what you can do if you find them in your life. Speaking of lives, I can't believe that I've come to this point in mine. I've been in regular contact now since February of 2016. In short, I've done what I set out to do when I began walking in the woods at night in 1986. A long road, or rather, path. People are going to ask, of course, well, how can we detect this? How can we confirm it? The only way to do that I know of is to confirm it in your own life. The reason I say that is that I've been trying since 1987 to get imagery or audio or something that would be confirming. This is not on the cards, apparently, at least not now and not for me. I'm ready for it to happen, though, as this apartment is well equipped with surveillance cameras. On the internet, you find lots of alien video. Almost all of it is fake. There are a few pieces that are probably not fake, and if you go into Unknown Country search engine, click on the Out There section and search alien stick figures, you will find some video that we believe to be authentic. It's not the Greys. It looks nothing like anything that we have ever seen or spoken, discussed publicly before. It's totally unique, but we do think it's authentic. Do all visitors look like this? Well, of course, I have no idea. But some apparently do, as strange as that may seem. So here we are journeying down this incredible road together. Where will it lead? Gosh, I cannot tell you that, but I can tell you that I lead a life of high adventure because of the visitors. That's for darn sure. And I think that if you join the adventure, you're going to find it at least a very, very interesting experience. The first part of this edition of Dreamland was recorded in the field, actually at Josh Boone's home, and there's a little background noise in that part of the show. Josh, my friend, welcome to Dreamland.
Well, thank you for coming today. Whitley came to my place where I'm actually writing something related to our work together. And we're sitting here with my dog, Charlie. But yeah, I thought maybe we could start by doing something interesting, which is I wondered if in a really short period of time, we could sit together and you could walk me and the audience through the sensing exercise. I think that's sort of, is that an interesting way to start since the book's so much about that?
Well, the sensing exercise, what the sensing exercise does is it changes the energy structure of your physical system in such a way that you become more visible in other levels of reality. In other words, you set up a glow. And if you do this enough, eventually somebody might get interested and come to you and start to teach you, if you wish.
How long? I feel like you've been doing this for a very long time, this particular meditation. You've talked to me about it a lot.
Yeah, well, I've been doing it since 1970, and it was 15 years of the exercise before the visitors showed up in my life, and
I was not doing the exercise in order to attract any attention of any kind. I was doing it to strengthen my own second body. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, bang, here they were. They had apparently seen me, and I had been with them when I was a child, and they thought to themselves, apparently, well, here he is, and he's still trying. Let's see how he's doing. And they came into my house. I didn't expect that. I didn't know what they were anymore. I'd forgotten my childhood experiences entirely, and I just basically went berserk. I bought guns. I put up an alarm system. And then the next thing they knew, guns or alarm system aside, they took me out in the middle of the night.
And, you know, we're also working a little bit with Ed Conroy, whose book Report on Communion I was attracted to, because he went and investigated your experiences and spoke to a lot of people you knew over the course of your life.
Yeah.
In a lot of data ways, validated a lot of your experiences, at least in so much as other people had had strange experiences with you and in your vicinity.
Well, that does tend to happen.
It does tend to happen.
Just to go back to the sensing exercise, my listeners of this show know that they can get the sensing exercise in the subscriber area.
Right.
So there's no sense in actually going through the exercise now. But just know that it's there, folks. And if you're not a subscriber, you should be one and you can get it. And it's a valuable thing to do. Also, I'm noticing that when people set out to develop a relationship with the visitors by using the exercise, they seem to be getting a little farther, a little faster than I did, in the sense that, you know, I wasn't trying to at all. I didn't even know they existed, or had forgotten that they existed, and had never really known what they were when I was a child. I called them the spacemen.
Or even now, though, I mean, I feel like you got sort of misrepresented and lumped into a category of people who, during that time, even though your book sold 10 million copies probably, you know, they sort of decried you as somebody talking about nuts and bolts, UFOs, and extraterrestrials, and you always were so much more less certain about that than anyone really gave you credit for back then.
Well, yeah, but the general media isn't about facts and truth and real exploration. It's about sensation. That means that what I had that could be sensational was, he's claiming contact with aliens. Ha, ha, ha. We can make him into a laughingstock. We can bully him. We can make jokes about him. Or we can prove that he's a liar.
It's funny because I kind of see it as you had a visionary experience. I tend to think a lot more about this the way that your colleague and your friend Jeff Kripal thinks about it. He kind of feels, I don't know, a lot more the way I do when we read works of Jacques Vallée, that this is, I don't know, I think about Philip K. Dick. I think about Robert Anton Wilson. I actually wanted to start, and maybe you'd let me read. I want to read a little bit from your book and tell you a little bit. Well, this part in particular really reminds me of Philip K. Dick in a beautiful way. He's another, you know, famous author who had visionary experiences that people, I think, were maybe more open to at the time because it was the 60s and 70s and everybody was on drugs.
You're right. Well, they're really, people are much more closed down now than they were when Communion came out.
Totally.
Much more.
And Robert Anton Wilson also, who's the artist who did Conan? Barry Windsor Smith had visionary experiences when he was doing art.
And, you know, Philip K. Dick and I were linked in some strange way. We were both obsessed with ancient Rome.
Yeah.
And we shared the same agent. Phil Dick had died before I came along, but Russell Galen was still the agent of his estate. I suppose he still is.
I
was Russell's client for many years.
Huh. Were these on your first couple horror novels, The Wolf Inn and The Hungry?
No. This was much later.
Huh.
Much later. I came to Russell in late 90s, I believe.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to read a little bit from The New World, just one little section, because it really reminds me a lot of one of my favorite sections of a Philip K. Dick book called Valis, which is one of my favorite Philip K. Dick books. It's one of the very best. It was about his mystical experience. So I'm going to read this very briefly, and then I'd love to talk to you about this. You said, "The next thing I knew, I was lying in bed again, but not in any sort of comfortable state. Instead, I was dreaming that I was living five different lives at once. Later, I assumed that if this had been a real event, whatever that means, they were unfolding in parallel lives, if not in parallel universes. One of them was this life as I was living it then. I continued, the five of them were distinct, and I was inside five different selves at once. There was no confusion, and I wasn't on the outside looking in. I was living these lives all at the same time. My most vivid recollection looking back is how normal this fantastic state seemed while it was unfolding. I wrote, in four of these lives, Anne was also present, but not in the fifth, and that was a life I very much wanted to leave. In it, I was walking down a path with a small boy towards a quay where there were a number of men. I went on. In this universe, Anne had died of her stroke, and I was walking with my grandson, who was about three. At the time, I didn't have a three-year-old grandson, and when my oldest grandson was three in 2010, Anne was still fine. When my youngest one will be three in 2021, she will have been on the other side for 7 years. So that wasn't exactly prophetic. In the next life, I was still living in my childhood home in San Antonio, which was now worn out and run down. Anne was bravely trying to scrub the kitchen floor. The house has long since been torn down and replaced by another house. It had been in 2007 too. In a third reality, we were living together in an apartment and the dogs were under the bed. Fingers had grasped my hand and were tugging at it. I now know that both the presence of dogs and the tugging on my hand had to do with things that would happen in the future. So I assume that if these were actual parallel universes and not simply possible alternate lives, that this has to have been the one I'm actually living in, as we shall see. The fourth reality was the one where the trees were in the living room. In this one, TV transmissions from another planet were being regularly picked up and rebroadcast by SETI, and this was a decorative motif from the other world. And I have to say that I hope that this actually happens in this universe at some point, but I hasten to add that I'm not going to be buying into the idea of having trees in my living room. At 4:53, the yanking on my hand grew strong enough to wake me up. Pulling it away, I turned over, saw that there was actually nothing there, and decided absurdly to try to get some sleep. The blinds were slightly opened, and as I turned over, I saw lights outside the window. The wind was blowing in from the sea, and the clouds were racing, but these lights were dead still in the sky and close by. I immediately woke Anne up, and we soon discovered that we could both see the lights, but only when we were in a certain position in the bed. From any other angle, they were invisible. So I find that stuff fascinating. Philip K. Dick wrote vividly also in Valis about experiencing his father's life simultaneous right. to his own in a sort of a hypnagogic state like you experienced this in. What was this experience like and how much time did it take place over?
Well, it must have taken place in well under 15 minutes. And it was extremely disorienting because... You know, I kept trying to kind of find my way. I couldn't figure out where I was. I was, and yet my consciousness was spread between these lives, and they all felt like my life. And yet, even in one of these lives, I was also in all of the others at the same time. And that's where the disorientation came in. Because it was like, you know, you lift your hand to your nose in one life and you're scratching your ear in another with the same hand and you feel both things. That was the weirdness.
A very bizarre feeling, I bet.
It was really bizarre. And yet it came about because I had read a few days before, read a story about the possible existence of parallel universes.
Yes.
And I wrote a journal entry for Unknown Country about it because back in 1998, the Master of the Key said something that was completely outrageous then, that there was essentially an infinity of universes out there.
Did you feel some of this as well in Michael Talbot's work, who you talk about in Breakthrough, who his book, The Holographic Universe, I read very, I was very engaged in that book when it came out in the 90s.
Well, that was an interesting book. I'm glad he managed to get it out. It was really hard. You know, I'll tell you, this is a story about Michael. We were good friends, Ben and him and I. And we one night he called and he said, I have an absolutely amazing story to tell you. I almost lost the book. It was still on his computer at the time. But I've got it still. And I said, first thing I said, Michael, do you have, make a copy of it and put it somewhere. You can do that. You know, there are these things called discs. But any case, this is what had happened. He lived in a basement apartment on Central Park West in Manhattan, and somebody came in, broke in, and was stealing his computer, and everything on the whole book was on his computer. And he had a cat. I knew the cat. The cat was sort of like an elderly, kind of overweight cat puddle. Everyone knows what those cats look like.
Sure.
They're about as defenseless and helpless as they can be. This is the sweetest animal in the world. When the burglar ignored Michael and started to out with the computer, the cat leaped into action, jumped on the guy's face from the floor, and started just savaging him. The guy dropped the computer, ran out the door. The cat jumped off the guy. Michael ran in back into the apartment. Michael slammed the door and closed it, and the cat went back to sleep. That was it. That was the cat. The only thing like that the cat did in his entire existence. And so the book was saved.
But that book opened me up to a lot of ideas in quantum physics that I went and read about more deeply later, but he really made me think about parallel universes the way Philip K. Dick made me think about it.
He was an opener of doors.
Yeah.
He was a very wonderful man. I remember just the day before he died, he called up and you could barely hear his voice because he was struggling, obviously, greatly. And he said, "Whitley, I want to tell you that I'm dying and I love you." And I said, "Oh, Michael, I love you too." And that was the last of him.
Anne was close to him as well, yes.
Oh, very close to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, we cried together after that call.
Oh.
But, you know, it has to happen. Life goes on and nobody survives. Like my doctor, one of my doctors says, "Whitley, I have to warn you, I have a 100% death rate in my practice." The other doctors say, any doctor who says that, he shouldn't say that. I said, "Why not? It's the truth."
What you just said made me think of when you saw the coffin. You talk about this in the book. Would you talk about that? Because that was a powerful moment from the book.
This is at the core of why the visitors are here, I think. The coffin. I was walking in the woods, doing my night walks in the woods outside my cabin back in the old days, and I was creeping along with this gigantic flashlight. I had a flashlight that was, the barrel of it was about 20 feet long, filled with millions of batteries. You could light
shoot it up in the sky.
Yeah, oh, God, you could shoot it up in the sky and planes would wave at you. But it could light a campfire at 50 feet. Anyway, so I will say this. I was not armed, and it was very hard to do that. Go out there.
It sounds terrifying. Like when I think about it,
these guys were monsters basically, and they were out there. They were there. They were definitely out there, and I was going out there alone.
I mean, and you sat in a cave by yourself and meditated. Sat in a cave with other people.
Absolutely.
That sounds petrifying.
I would go out to that cave, climb down the cliff, get into the cave, and go out there, go in there, and turn off the light. And I would sit there in the absolute darkness.
And do the sensing exercise.
Completely alone, unable to escape in any way whatsoever, and do the sensing exercise. And, the few things that happened were just so gentle. There would be little rustlings from time to time. Could have been them, and it could have been bats flying past. I don't know. It was a small cave, though. I don't think it had bats. But every once in a while, something would happen, like someone would touch my cheek gently, like someone was encouraging me.
Right.
But anyway, let's get back to the coffin. We were talking about the coffin.
Tell the listeners about that.
This old guy, little visitor, one who was old, in my opinion.
And this is, when you say someone who's old, this is something you sensed and felt through whatever communication that you had.
Yeah, I felt that this was someone old. I didn't see him really, sort of in my mind's eye, but I felt like he was right there. So I sat down, and I found a place to sit, probably a log or something, and I started doing the sensing exercise. And I asked a question out loud: "What does the universe mean to you?" The answer was immediate. There was, in my mind's eye, as bright as a television screen, there was a picture of a coffin. A coffin.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, God, how depressing. I talk about this extensively in the book because they are trapped in their knowledge. In other words, I think they know everything. And that is a trap. And they get relief by joining their consciousness to ours because we don't know nothing. For them, the universe is a coffin. For us, it's Star Trek.
Well, what they want to achieve is maybe what we have a hard time achieving too. Would you say that they want to be present?
They want a return to innocence and to be able to experience surprise.
And when you say this, you still don't even really claim to know what they are.
No, but I'm saying what.
This is your perception.
Yeah, this is what my perception of their aim here is.
Exactly.
It's a trade. They're going to give us knowledge. We're going to give them an open door to ourselves so that they can participate in the wonders of life that we experience every moment. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
And you felt that the coffin represented the way they perceived reality without us, interaction with us.
Yeah, because, you know, we always say, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful to know the future? No, it would not. No, it would definitely not. Because you know your future, you have no life.
And every work of fiction about knowing the future is usually negative consequences associated with it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I had this isn't in the book because it's too vague, but I think I had a taste of knowing the future. And it wasn't a taste of knowing the future in 5400 AD or something, but of knowing my immediate future. And all of a sudden, I was sitting doing the sensing exercise, and I knew I would get up and what I would do. And it was like being on rails. It was horrible. I just began to move. And it was all mechanical. I knew what would happen. Not as intellectual knowledge, but as a body feeling, if you can understand that, if I'm making any sense.
Sure.
It was like my body was kind of moving automatically. And I could see more of this in the distance. In other words, there would be no surprise, nothing new in a life like that. Not ever.
You know every twist and turn, every moment,
twist and turn.
Everything you're going to say before you said it. And that's what Philip K. Dick feared, was it not, was to be a robot, to be an android.
We were in the same wavelength, obviously. In the same sort of mystical space.
Yep.
But I learned then in that moment, this is a disastrous situation. You can't live like this. It's horrible. And of course, then I thought to myself, of course, they come to me every night and they come and they are inside me and they come in me. It was a long years of struggle. It was terrifying at first. Then I was so suspicious that they were, you know, possessing me or something. And then I realized what they really wanted, which was to participate in the newness of my experience. And so the last thing they want to do is possess you. They want you to be free so that they can share what you're getting. And there's a real sense of sharing now. And they're not stealing my life. They're tasting it with me.
Talk to me a little bit about something else you speak about in the book and you've talked about a couple times, but I think it's a really interesting story. And I think Jeff is a highly credible person. Like, how did you meet Jeff? And I'd love to hear the story about what happened when he stayed in your room at Esalon. That's a great story.
Well, I met Jeff. Jeff wrote me a letter on whitley@streiber.com, as I recall. And just introduced himself, and I thought to myself, well, this is an interesting guy. And I looked at a couple of his books and I thought, this man is actually a real expert. This is a serious man.
For anybody who doesn't know, he's the J. Newton Razor Professor of Religion at Rice University. He's written several what I would consider genius level books about metaphysical concerns in regards to religion and spirituality, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we can admit that Jeff is a genius. He's a genius. He's an absolute genius.
Diana as well, both professors of religion, correct?
Yeah, Diana is Diana Walsh Basilka. Yeah,
who wrote American Cosmic. Right. Those two, it's just interesting. We speak a lot about this less in science fiction terms and more in spiritual terms, right?
Let's get to the story of Jeff at Esalen and what happened.
Yeah.
Jeff wanted to stay in the room with me, which is going to be quite possibly an adventure. If the visitors show up, they're going to be there for anyone who happens to be in the room. It's not like only Whitley. So they did show up that night. One of them did. And this is exactly what happened. First of all, to give you a setting, the room is at Esalen. It overlooks the Pacific Ocean and it's in Big Sur. And it's on a cliff. It's a beautiful place. And the room actually has a deck that overlooks the ocean. It's just a perfectly beautiful place. It's called the Sea View Room in the Murphy House at Esalen, if you ever want to stay in it. In any case.
And Jeff wrote a book about its history.
Yes, Jeff has written a book about Esalen's history. He's on the board of directors of Esalen. And in any case, what happened was this. I had an experience. I was lying next to the window in my bed with my head turned toward the window. Someone then blew on my left hand, which was away from the window, causing me to turn to the left and open my eyes and just glimpse this individual. Because if I had looked directly at this person, and I go into this in depth in the book, if I had looked directly at this person, it would have been very difficult for me.
In what way?
Well, it is...
Other than terrifying.
It challenges the ego, because reflected back is the certainty of your own death. And the ego dies with the body, and it knows that. And it is scared of that. You have to work inwardly very much to get yourself to come to peace with the parts of you that will die.
Yes.
And to get them to come to peace.
The parts of you that cause existential despair.
Right, exactly. But anyway, so a little while later, Jeff had the experience. And it is devastating, because this tremendous sense of... of implosion of self happens. And it happened to him, because the visitor, he said he perceived it as this horrible racket, this terrible noise. And then a sense of something deep inside himself, a voice that was him, but not the him that is living in the outside world, said, "Oh my God."
It was like a voice in his head.
In his head, because the danger here is the ego is being threatened by facing its mortality raw, with no buffers. And two, the person is being threatened by being pulled out of the time stream by the mere presence of this being, which is a being from outside the time stream.
Was it Valet who said that they penetrate our reality?
They penetrate, as Jacques said that, penetrate our reality. And we must not be pulled out of the time stream. We're fish swimming in the water of the time stream. Pull us out, and we are no longer any access to our reality.
Right.
We are lost.
It's like pulling a fish out of the water or whatever.
Exactly. Pulling a fish out of the water. We're here absorbing the experiences that flow toward us through time. and you pull us out and we are really are a fish out of water. And that's how it feels. And that's what scared Jeff so badly.
And how did he feel about it the next morning? When did you guys speak about it?
right. As soon as we woke up.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. It was sort of like the guy, the scientist at the IONS Institute he's working in a very difficult area. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
And he was looking for some kind of a moral direction. And the visitors helped him. They helped him by taking me out of my body and putting me in the room with him. And he woke up and we had a conversation about the moral journey of life. And he converted to Catholicism after that. It wouldn't have been my choice based on the conversation we had, but it was his.
Yeah.
So, and it's fine. As I say in my book, that really all the religions have effective means of building a strong soul. You just have to be very careful that you don't turn into a believer, and especially someone who's trying to force others to believe as you do.
Exactly. I mean, I kind of look at it like people have strange experiences, and to demonize them or make them feel awkward discussing it seems like negating what human beings should be doing, which is communicating with each other. I think it reminds me of the quote you put at the beginning of this book that Valet said, where it says, mythology exists at a level of our social reality over which normal political intellectual action has no power.
No power,
which makes me feel like communion, like Philip K. Dick's story that became countercultural, 101 when Crumb went and drew it, and Barry Windsor Smith stuff and Robert Anton Wilson. It all becomes part of popular culture and the collective unconscious.
And it's also why the intelligence community works so hard to crank out horror stories, because the only thing that they have that can control the population's relationship with this is fear.
Are you talking specifically kind of about like the TTSA speaking so much about threats, military threats,
threats,
all that stuff.
The threat stuff.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, the military's been fighting them since 1947. And then people who are involved at that, in that level of it, come to me and they say, well, they're very aggressive. I said, look, you shot first. They're defending themselves. You don't shoot at them and they're eventually going to calm down, but it's going to take a long time.
For anybody who doesn't know, talk a little bit about your connection with those events in the late 40s.
Oh, sure. I think most of my listeners know, but I'll be very brief.
Sure.
My uncle was involved in the assembly of the debris that was brought from Roswell to Wright Field in Dayton at General Ramey's request. And his commanding officer, Arthur Exon, general now, before he died, he eventually became general and commanding officer at Wright Pat, was also involved, and they told me their stories, essentially. And
this was later in their lives,
yeah,
after you had written your book, right?
After I'd written out my book, and I said to, I think I said it to Mickey, that I said, this sounds all very secret and hush-hush. And he said, well, it is. I said, well, aren't you violating the law by telling me? And he said, no. I said, well, what does that mean? He says, it means what it says. I'm not violating the law by telling you what I'm telling you now. I said, but are these secrets? He said, yes, they are. So you're letting the secrets out and it's not against the law. That means that you've been ordered to talk to me about this. And he said, I wouldn't say ordered, but yeah. So someone at some point in their lives told him to, let Whitley in on this, a little bit of this. And they did. And I wrote Majestic based on a lot of what they said. Of course, there's a lot of fiction in Majestic, too.
A really well-received book from the early 90s that Putnam released.
It helped bring the whole Roswell issue back to life.
Right.
So
that's a book I read when I was young. I've certainly been reading your book since the late 80s, which is a lot of my interest in working with you and discussing all this stuff.
Oh, thank you.
I was going to read one more quote from the front of the book that you put. I mean, obviously, it comes with a foreword by Mr. Kripal, who says this book is Contact. You quote Terence McKenna, who says, "We are part of a symbiosis with something that disguises itself as an alien invasion so as not to alarm us."
I love that quote. Terence and I were not friends. I'm taken out of context all the time because people have to get into my work a little bit and not just see what happened on Larry King.
Right.
You know, for God's sakes, I'm more than that.
Well, I guess think about, too, it's like the journey you've gone through in your life from kind of like coming out and dealing with that stuff publicly in the 80s through now. It's like, you know, you're just like Philip K. Dick or any of these other people. It's a constantly shifting thing that you're thinking about, where new thoughts arise, new experiences happen. You come up with new possibilities about what this stuff could be. You never kind of stop thinking. Right?
It's an always open, changing
conversation with reality.
It's well, when I challenged the visitors in February of 2016, I said, we got need help here. We need help. You have got to, if they have no interest in politics, I've been through that with them as none.
Well, no, but if they did, it wouldn't be normal people having experiences like this.
No, but they do have interest in our survival. That means they are interested in environmental issues, which is why.
Well, then that precedes even, well, your memories of this stuff are preceded by War Day, which is in Nature's End, which are two books that I feel like were very important books that dealt with that even in the 1980s.
Yeah, they did. In the early 80s, they did deal with it. And I think that maybe I was kind of beginning to intersect with the visitors in those days in terms of ideas.
Tell me about the other thing I'd ask, which is to me the most powerful chapter of the book is your trip to Wounded Knee. I know you've probably spoken about this on the show already.
Not much.
To me, this is a really incredible chapter in the book. I feel like it connects to something that I've always been curious about, which is, you know, when I was young and I saw these books, I, of course, thought that it had to do with aliens and extraterrestrials,
right?
Like Betty and Barney Hill, that sort of thing. Read more of your work over the years and slowly realize by reading other people's work that it's so much more than that. You feel that this is also, and this is why I bring up this chapter, you feel it's connected to the dead in some way.
Oh, very
I feel
definitely.
Like the experience you had at a Wounded Knee, your perception of your time there, you dealt with that part of the reality of it to a larger degree. I just wanted to ask you about that and about how those two things dovetail for you.
I think that the visitors are not necessarily entirely the dead. But they don't have a barrier between what we call the living and what we call the dead. And when you're near them, neither do you. And so the result is our dead are coming out. The closer the visitors get to us, the closer our dead get to us. It happens simultaneously. But I want to go back to what we were starting to discuss a moment ago, which is that what happened in 2016, I was begging them to, you know, come out to validate all of the close encounter witnesses who, and me too, who have this message about the environment. Because we're dying here. This planet is in trouble.
Would you say?
And we have no leadership.
Would you say in the communion letters that you and Anne received that are held at Rice University that a lot of them shared similar concerns to environmental stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. A lot of them. So the result of this was I was saying, I'm not scared of you anymore. So, and they were saying, we can't communicate because people have no idea how to communicate with us. One, and two, there's too much fear. And so then I've told this story already on my site, but they proceeded to prove to me that I was still scared of them.
Huh.
But then there proceeded the next 2 years was the most intimate, most productive period of teaching I have experienced with them in my life. They wrote this book with me. side by side, literally.
You were definitely under a lot of pressure when you were writing the book.
Well, you remember.
Totally. I mean, I read all the drafts of this book while you wrote it.
You read seven drafts.
I really did. I mean, because I was, you know, deep into reading all your stuff and working on the project we're working on. And, yeah, it was fascinating to watch the journey this book took and how much you felt it was important to get it right.
If the book works, they're going to be able to come into the lives of more people. And there's going to be so much resistance. People who have been propagandized into believing that there's something evil, who take pleasure in that. They want to be frightened and they want to hate. And there's this very dark, negative thing here. But there are also people who have a much more mature vision of this. They're not all sweetness and light at all. But these people, a lot of whom are on my website, at least 400 or 500 of the people who are actively engaged as subscribers on my website can do this. I can tell by the way they respond and they write in comments and so forth. These are people who are ready to take another step with the visitors. And that doesn't mean giving anything up at all. It means opening a door in yourself that you didn't even know you had. And when you do open that door, there's something that comes in that we can't even understand what exactly it is. But it happens. It comes in. And you become a new kind of a person. You become a much bigger person. You are never possessed. Nothing is controlling you. In fact, very much the opposite.
You said it was sharing a space.
It's sharing a space. It's like a very, very marriage to someone who is very smart and very patient. Very gentle, but also very persistent.
Well, I mean,
not going away. Once they're in there, they're not going away. You're married.
And you've experienced certainly since the mid 80s. I mean, maybe even earlier than that, what people would call poltergeist phenomena in your homes,
sure.
with many witnesses who've been there, who I've spoken to, who experienced these things. You know?
Well, the visitors used to come to the cabin in the 80s.
Right.
And they came to the cabin when there were a lot of people there,
yep,
on purpose to show themselves to the people, they would do
Ed anything. As well. Also,
Ed Conroy had a hell of a lot of. It's up to Ed to talk about his experiences at the cabin.
We'll have to.
Some very cool experiences there. That's all I can say.
When we get further down the line, we'll do another talk like this with him as well. So you guys can talk about those experiences.
He got a ride on a bus that he didn't have to pay for.
I'm trying to. Well, go back one more time. Well, can you touch a little bit on that trip to Wounded Knee? How that came about?
We're running.
Dangerously
this is
close.
This is a conversation, not an interview. But in any case, I got contacted by a lady named Mira Ferolito that she had a little conference that she was going to have at Wounded Knee on the Lakota Sioux Reservation, and would I be interested in going? And I thought to myself, a conference on an Indian reservation, of course I'm interested. So I said yes. And I went to the conference, and it was in a little place called the All Nations Conference Center on the reservation, which was run by a man with a very big, powerful soul called Dallas Chief Eagle. But I knew what was there when I saw Dallas. I knew this is a man who had lived and was living and was connected to this planet. He was. So the conference had a hell of a lot of energy.
And how many people came?
Oh, about 20. Okay. Maybe 20 up top.
So small and focused.
Small and focused, yeah. And it was so small that one couple decided they didn't like the layout, that it was too primitive, and they left without paying, meaning that Mia ended up in deficit and couldn't pay any of us the little bits that we had been offered. And so I ended up paying my airfare and my everything and getting no honorarium, but I didn't really care because, you know, the conference itself was more important than making a little money. that's my life is I'm always doing things that are more important than making a little money. And then I look at my bank account and think, holy God, what am I going to do now? But in any case, when I was at Wounded Knee, when I was on the reservation, I had the single most incredible experience of my life of living in two worlds at the same time. I go into it deeply in the book.
Yep.
And, you know, folks, you can
and
just
this is something that has nothing to do with the visitors, doesn't have anything to do. Like, this is a lot more like what we talked about at the beginning, this idea of different realities.
Yes. It's a very much different realities. And, you know, we have to wake up to the fact that we are in a really big place and we're hiding in a kind of little room that we call the physical world or the familiar world. But there are a whole lot of other rooms and great, beautiful vistas that we dare not look at because it's too frightening. But hey, I'm sick of being scared. I'm in rebellion against my own fear. I want to see what's there and experience the wonder of this. Because a lot of people who experience this, not humans, but other people, can't experience it through the in the flow of time. We have that incredible privilege because we live in time. And we can see this world in terms of wonder.
That's something I guess I felt the most when I went with you and Ed to San Antonio to see some places that were important to you when you were a child. This sense that you guys perhaps live your life with a bit more wonder than a lot of other people. Sort of whether one thinks anything of what's like I said, it's your perceptions and his perceptions, and you guys have experienced some highly interesting things. And it's like you live in a much more open and much more fascinating world because the possibilities are endless.
Well, you know,
like children at play, another Philip K. Dick, I think about the divine invasion where God has forgotten to play.
Yeah.
Right?
God laughs and plays. If God forgets to play, we're all in trouble.
God laughs and plays. Exactly. We were in the woods together, you and me and Ed, looking for the tree. And I just thought to myself, we're quite lucky to get to do any of this, you know?
The secret school tree is what he's talking about, folks.
Yeah. I was like, we're quite lucky to get to wander around the woods as adults and look for a magic tree, you know?
Yeah, and when you go there, you think, oh my God, it actually is a magic tree.
It's one incredible, wonderful tree.
A wonderful tree. That tree has to be... I'm so careful about this, and I would love folks to show you exactly where the tree is. But this, we live in a dark world, it's a fallen world, and if that, the location of that tree was disclosed, it would not be a month before someone would go out there and kill it.
Protect that tree like the Rose in the Dark Tower series. It was in a vacant lot and they had to protect it and you couldn't tell anybody where it was.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is important to protect the tree. And the tree, I've had it looked at by an arborist and he said it's probably the oldest tree in the state of Texas.
Wow.
And it is certainly over 500 years old.
It is a massive, hugely impressive tree and it feels alive and it feels like it's very old.
Yeah.
I'd say one more thing before we wrap up. I wanted to talk again just real briefly. I know you had him on, but Witness of Another World, which is out now and is new, is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen about the phenomenon, about somebody having a strange experience that impacted their lives emotionally, spiritually, all that.
He was a 12-year-old boy
who Jacques wrote about in one of his books in his trilogy. I think it was in Confrontations.
Confrontations. Jacques and Alan Stivelman really, really gave him a tremendous gift when they made the new documentary. Mm. Jacques wanted to go back to him. He had seen him, interviewed him 30 years ago or something.
And this was a little boy who lived in the middle of nowhere.
Right. I think he interviewed him 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And to give you, folks, those of you who don't know the story, he was out, I believe, looking for a horse, and he saw, looking for some cattle on a horse.
He brought his horse with him, yeah.
And he kind of saw this fog bank, and he walked into it, and there was this thing that he'd never seen anything like it before, with a ladder down to the ground. And so he went up the ladder and went into it. I mean, he wasn't abducted or anything. And he saw in there a little creature cutting up a part of a cow. In other words, there was a cattle mutilation in progress inside the thing. And there was a very tall being there. And he tried to walk.
He said no blood, right? I feel like.
No blood. And he tried to walk toward them, and he was prevented from moving forward by a sort of force field. And he had a brief interaction with them and then left. And the rest of his life has been basically about that experience.
He still lives where he grew up, right?
Right.
It was very sad in some ways to watch, because this was somebody who had clearly been traumatized. There's a lot of footage that was taken when he was a kid, interviews with him, some public interviews with him. It made me think a bit about you and your experience, where you definitely had a perception of something just like he did. And, people sort of laughed and made fun instead of hearing you out and listening to what you had to say.
Well, you know, the thing that's amazing is nicest people, when they are frightened, turn into bullies very quickly.
Right.
And that happened to him. And he was very traumatized by it. But what Alan Stivelman did was so sacred and such a blessed thing to do. He put him on an airplane, his first airplane ride, and took him to the indigenous tribe that were his ancestors and reconnected him with them. And all of a sudden, he was in the presence of people whose ancient wisdom includes an understanding of what happened to
him. Exactly, experiences like
this. The same way I had when I was with Dallas Chief Eagle and the Indians at the Lakota Sioux Reservation. These were people who were, and you know, it's not that, oh, they know secrets about the aliens. No, they're connected to the earth.
They're still about sky people since their earliest written history, right?
But because they are connected to the earth, they're also in communication and in concert with the visitors in a real way. Because I know so many people working on the inside on the materials and on weapons and this and that and the other.
I can verify that that is true.
he knows some of them too.
Can verify that that is true.
And they are in a very dark place, wandering, as one of the visitors said to Betty Andreasen, "Children of the Northern people, you wander in eternal darkness." That's where they are. But not the native, not the indigenous people.
Well, wouldn't you say most cultures are much more open to ours? And because ours is not open to it, it is absorbed into popular culture and into myth.
Well, that's very true. Into not myth, but folklore.
Folklore.
Yeah. And
if you're talking about UFOs, you're seeing folklore in the making even now.
Even now.
Yep.
And they're right now.
And it's on the New York Times, on the front page of the New York Times and everything else.
They're pushing out all kinds of scary folklore. Mm-hmm. And if you read those books that Peter Lavenda wrote for Tom DeLonge, they're full of scary folklore. And that's folklore. Like this business of the Greek gods were actually aliens. That comes from someone told Linda Howe about a book that turns out apparently not to exist. Because it's not possible that every single copy of the book around the world was hidden or taken up by the NSA or something. There's no trace of this book anywhere. And the book supposedly reveals the fact that the Greek gods were ancient, were actually aliens. But the truth of the matter is the Greek gods are part of us. They're part of the human spirit and the human mind. They're not aliens, and they never were aliens.
They're us.
but this kind of disinformation is pushed out in order to confuse the public and, above all, to disempower people.
And I'd say the more it's literalized and the more it is forced into a box, the less interesting it becomes.
Yeah. It's not true.
Right.
And therefore, if you're operating in a direction of something that isn't true, You're failing.
Yeah.
You're being tricked into failing because a lot of very strong, very good souls could take advantage of what's on offer. And that is just what the intelligence community is afraid of because they don't understand it themselves and they're terrified.
But you feel this is almost like the way that the government, I'm sure, was afraid of the message of Christianity, which is free to everyone who wants to take it.
Right? Yeah, the Roman government was very upset about Christianity, as we know.
Because that was left in somebody's personal hands.
Right. Suddenly, the relationship between God and man was personalized. And then the Council of Nicaea comes in and says, oh, no, we're going to repoliticize this. We are the ones. We are the arbiters. We are the church. We have the grace. You have to come to us. In other words, the demon acted immediately to close the door on the grace that Jesus left.
Right.
And that Council of Nicaea closed that door and sealed it. And it's been sealed ever since. And it's coming unsealed for a lot of people.
Yeah. As you know, I was raised by very, very religious evangelical Christians. And although I'm not religious anymore in any way, I still find the story of Jesus to hold mythological power. In a really real way, you know?
Yeah, of course it does.
It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. If enough people believe in something, it's true, you know?
By the way, when I say the intelligence community as a group, I'm talking only about part of it.
By the way, you can go read books about this part of the intelligence community and this part of the government. Try the bestseller, The Evangelicals, where there is definitely a part of our government that are born-again Christians that have imposed on your phenomena and the phenomena people talk about, religious convictions.
The first head of the Air Force, Curtis LeMay, apparently thought they were demons from what I've been told. Pretty sure it was General Exon who said that to me.
And that they must be ignored because they're demons.
And must be ignored because they're demons.
Right.
That was emphasized or expanded by John von Neumann, one of the physicists who was in the scientific committee studying this. He said that it's possible that the reason they can't invade us is because we don't know they exist.
Exactly.
And therefore, we must keep this, we must deny, deny, deny. And so the two things coincided. The evangelicals saying, ignore them because they're demons.
Right.
And the scientists saying, ignore them because if we open that door in our minds, we can never close it again. And now here I came along and I said, screw it. I'm going to open the door in my mind. And I did. I went out in the woods at night, night after night after night, and I opened the door in my mind. And here I am with a lovely relationship with these very tough, very demanding people who will continue to give me knowledge and to help my soul to grow as long as I remain engaged with them.
The book is A New World. It is really, really an incredible book, a mysterious book, an interesting book. It has got quotes from some incredible people, Jeff Kripal, Diana Pasulka, among others. It is really a wonderful book. You guys should check it out. This is Whitley Strieber here on Dreamland.
Okay, thank you very much.
Talking to you, Josh, as always.
It was so cool. Jeremy Vaney is going to do the same thing on Dreamland in a week or two. And I do hope you all get the book, folks, because this book, Jeff Kripal says, right, this book is Contact. If you read this, you're going to be able to do contact.
And it's funny. All Whitley's really telling you to do is go meditate.
Right. But meditate from a standpoint of real knowledge, and then you can move ahead.
Next up for subscribers, I'm going to be talking about some sections of the book and reading from the book and discussing just exactly what this all means in terms of our lives and our future, because it means a lot. This week in particular, I'm going to be addressing a question that is going to become more and more important and is already very important in a lot of people's lives. What about the dark side of this thing? What do we do with that if they do indeed come closer? And if you're not a subscriber but are a listener, I urge you to subscribe because it's important and it's getting more important over time. This site is going to be the place where most of the useful information actually appears first. It's as simple as that. And later it'll change. But right now, if you want to understand this, this is the community that is farthest along in this whole process, not just Whitley, but the whole community. It's a really vital community. So think about joining us and participating. You do that by going to unknowncountry.com and press on the subscribe tab and subscribe. It's extremely simple. Yeah, we use PayPal or credit cards. It's $4.95 a month, and you can get longer subscriptions if you wish. You can easily cancel your account anytime right in your account records. You don't have to write anybody or ask or anything like that.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.